From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, 11:11, we see it everywhere, don't we? The time prompt phenomenon with Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman. We get some answers on 11:11. Well, they've got him, that missing billionaire found in Virginia. The FBI agents located financier Robert Allen Stanford, and they served him with papers accusing him and three of his companies of orchestrating a $9.2 billion investment fraud scheme. Stanford, who was located in Fredericksburg, Virginia, has no criminal charges pending against him and was not taken into custody. They did get his passport. The Securities and Exchange Commission said Stanford was behind a fraud of shocking magnitude, and the FBI served him a copy of the SEC complaint. The FBI won't talk about a criminal investigation of his activities, but federal law enforcement officials familiar with the case leave no doubt that federal agents are investigating his financial dealings. Be on guard. A handful of Canadian women were scammed out of almost $300,000 in one of those Nigerian romance hoaxes. For one woman, the online dating scheme started when the unidentified middle-aged divorcee received text messages last year from a man about 10 years younger than her. They said, "You know, you're a very pretty lady. I like your profile." After several more emails, instant messages, and phone calls, the man promised to come to Canada and marry her. Then came the requests for money, including one that claimed the man's son was hospitalized and needed three surgeries. The scheme continued for about 5 months. They never even met at that point. "I had so many friends tell me, 'Don't send money,' she said. 'But you love that person. You believe what they say. You just don't want to stop.' Prompted by a friend, the victim called police, who say that she likely will never get her money back because they have to rely on Nigerian police to try to find the scammers. Don't send money to anyone like that. An important psychological barrier gave way on Wall Street as the Dow Jones Industrials fell to the lowest level now in more than 6 years. The Dow broke through a bottom reached in November, pulled down by a steep drop in the financial shares. Was the lowest close for the Dow since October 9 of 2002, when the last bear market bottomed out. In Pennsylvania, the American Civil Liberties Union has sued on behalf of a man whose company name, I Choose Hell Productions, was rejected by the state. Filmmaker George Coleman's request in 2007 to register as a business was turned down because of a state law prohibiting names that contain blasphemy or profanity. The lawsuit filed against Pennsylvania's Department of State contends the statute is unconstitutional because it relies on religious standards and violates Coleman's freedom of speech rights. Coleman says he decided to choose the name because he believes it is better to struggle through difficult times, that is, live in hell, than to commit suicide, for example. The lawsuit seeks undetermined damages and the use of the name. About a year or so ago, I was on a plane and they were passing out peanuts to everybody. And as they passed them all out, the flight attendants ran down the aisleway of the plane and collected all the peanuts again because one person on the plane was allergic to peanuts. So they pulled them all in. Well, now a group of children with peanut allergies have had their condition effectively cured. A team from Cambridge's hospital in the UK exposed four children to peanuts over a six-month period, gradually building up their tolerance. By the end of the period, the children were eating the equivalent of five peanuts a day. Now, that might not sound like a lot to you, but to them, it was huge. It's the first time a food allergy has been desensitized in such a way, although a longer-term follow-up is now needed to confirm those findings. If you get up to the hot stories at coasttocoastam.com, you'll see a couple of them. The first one: Japan invents mini-me robots. For $2,100, there's a company in Japan that will create an identical likeness to you, even replicating the sound of your voice. All you have to do is send them a photo and $2,100, and you'll get a robot that looks like you, and then you program it. It's got a computer in it and a voice recognition software, a microphone, and then you can take it with you, a little mini-me robot. Also, the other story on coasttocoastam.com, hot stories. There's talk that they may have found Atlantis, 620 miles off the coast of Africa. It's a perfect rectangle, the size of Wales, lying on the bed of the Atlantic Ocean. It could be a remarkable discovery. It's near the Canary Islands, a location for Atlantis seemingly suggested by the ancient philosopher Plato. He believed it was an island civilization sunk by an earthquake and floods around 9700 BC, nearly 12,000 years ago. We've got author Dorothy Cora Moore on the line with us. She has researched the story of Atlantis for more than 30 years. Hey, Dorothy, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, George?
Good. What do you think of this story?
Well, I find it fascinating. I'm just finishing reading it now, and I pulled out my atlas to take a look. It looks like it's around, in my own book, The Atlanteans, I have a lot of people think of Atlantis as a city, but it was a continent.
Yes.
And the capital city, I wrote that it's located at 30 degrees north latitude and 42 degrees west longitude. And it looks like this discovery is farther to the east, but it is around 30 degrees north latitude.
That's weird.
It really is weird, and it's kind of, you know, they don't give the longitude and latitude in the article, but as I look at the Canary Islands, and to give everybody listening tonight, 30 degrees latitude runs through New Orleans and maybe Jacksonville, Florida,
mm-hmm.
and it goes all the way across the ocean into the northern part of Africa, just below Spain, into Morocco, through Morocco, and then Algeria, Libya, Egypt. And what's interesting about it is that it looks like it's just below the Azores and above and to the left of the Canary Islands.
This was apparently spotted. This grid showed up on Google Ocean.
Yeah, it's exciting to see that. It could be a city. I don't think it's the capital
yeah,
city.
Yeah, what did you think of that picture? I mean, clearly there's something down there, right?
For sure. I just wish they would have given us more information. You never know if somebody has falsified something because it's so easy to do.
True. Good point.
And, but it is exciting to see something like this. It looks like a smaller city, maybe on the southeastern portion of the continent of Atlantis. And what city that is, we don't know. Is someone going to go down and take a look?
Maybe so, Dorothy. They haven't made any decisions about that yet. But I sure would hope so. Wouldn't that be something?
It would. And, you know, I noticed in the article also they talked about Plato's information on Atlantis.
Yes.
But Plato learned everything about Atlantis from his uncle. And it was his uncle that studied with in the mystery schools in Egypt.
See, they pass all that information down. Dorothy, thank you for your insight into this. Dorothy's website, theatlanteans.com. You know, that comet we've been talking about for a couple days now, that odd greenish backward-flying comet zipping by Earth this month as it takes its only trip toward the sun from the farthest edges of the solar system. The comet is called Lulin, discovered by a Chinese teenager 2 years ago. This is a very weird comet. We're turning to physicist James McCanney in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here he is, Professor James McCanney, physicist. He spent decades promoting his theoretical work, showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. James has presented his theories at the Los Alamos National Laboratories and the American Geophysical Union. He appears quite often here on Coast to Coast AM. Professor, how are you?
George, hi. How are you doing tonight?
Always a pleasure. Now, this is a great story of this backward green comet. First of all, what do they mean by backward comet?
Well, it's in a retrograde orbit, which means it's moving the opposite direction around the sun of the Earth and the planets. If you look from the northern side of the solar system, they move in a counterclockwise direction. This comet is moving in the other direction. So it came in from afar and is right now swinging around behind Earth in the direction of the orbit of Mars. Mars is not back there right now. But on Monday, it will be the closest to Earth at about 38 million miles away, certainly not going to hit Earth or anything, but it's brightening right now. But the relative speed of these two objects, Earth and this comet, is around 60,000 miles an hour. So these are the kinds that you sure would not want to run into nose-to-nose or even have them come by close because of the extremely high relative velocity of the comet.
No, not at all. And speaking of 38 million miles away, James, you sound like you're on that comet. Hey, can you get closer to your phone for me, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry. How's that? Is that better?
Much better. Much better. There you are.
Okay.
I thought you were doing one of those rides on a comet somewhere. You are off in the... in the solar system.
Oh, okay.
Little Chinese teenager, Lulin, yep, discovered this comet. How did he find it?
It was on plates that were actually taken from the Lulin Observatory, and he would sit down every night with these photographic plates and look for comets. And allegedly, he almost was the discoverer of Hale-Bopp. However, he was just like a day late with that discovery, and so he vowed that he would discover a comet someday, and in fact he did. So it was observing plates that were provided by Lulin Observatory, which is one of the university observatories over in China.
Now these comets are starting to get a little too close for comfort, James. Any possible danger here for us?
Well, it's very interesting, and of course standard science says this is very far away and nothing is going to happen. But Comet Lulin has a very unusual orbit, and we've seen these many times in the past, including Comet Holmes in December of 2007, which was instrumental in causing some severe hurricanes on Earth. The electrical size of this comet is very large, and we are going to come into direct alignment with that on around the 24th to the 28th of February. It's always difficult to make predictions, but the situation is as follows. We have four electrical alignments coming up here. We have Comet Lulin on the 26th, which will be in direct electrical alignment with Earth. We have the new moon, which is occurring, which means the moon is between us and the sun, and that will pass on about the 28th. In other words, that's when the solar wind will break free from the moon, and that solar wind will come crashing into Earth's magnetic field, which will cause an impulse. Then Venus is coming around and will actually be between us and the sun on March 27th, but it's starting to swing around. So this entire period, starting on around the 28th of February, what we very likely could see is Comet Lulin brightening all of a sudden, and some severe weather on Earth, something like possibly blizzards, small hurricanes, tornadoes, that type of activity. And it could last anywhere from 5 days to quite a few days.
Jeez. Now, they say it's possible you can see it with the naked eye, but they say if you have a telescope or at least binoculars, it might be even easier, huh?
Yes, binoculars would be good. There are star charts on the internet. That's the best way for people to locate this object. But basically, if you went out at 1 a.m., just to give people a little bit of a primer, if you went out at 1 a.m. in the northern hemisphere, look due south, you will see Saturn up in the sky, probably about 40 to 50 degrees up in the sky, depending on where you are. Then swing over to the eastern horizon, about halfway to the horizon, and you will see the star Spica. It's a very bright star in the constellation Virgo. And go midway between Saturn and Spica, and that's where the comet is. And I would observe it anywhere up to 4 a.m. That's when the moon rises tonight. And as we move into the upcoming days, the moon will be setting, will be rising later and later. So this next 7 to 8 days, will be very clear observing for this comet.
Jim, the Hopi prophecy talked about blue Kachina, which was an object. This is green. Pretty darn close, though. I wonder if this is the beginning of Hopi prophecy.
Well, this is a comet that's never come through the solar system before. And we see many comets. The green color is due to the characteristic fluorescence of I believe it's cyanide and carbon.
Yeah, it's a poisonous gas, right?
Yeah, and that's common in comet tails. But the thing is, this comet is very special because ever since it was discovered, it has a sunward spike, a very intense sunward spike. And standard science always tries to pretend like this is part of the tail or just something else breaking off of the comet nucleus and going to the sunward side, an optical illusion. But on January 24th, we were broadside to the comet, and it still had both the intense sunward spike and the tail going away from the sun, clearly an electrical discharge through the comet. And this comet's been very interesting, too, because it's lost its tail twice. Where the tail would break away and the solar wind would blow it away, you can actually see these events. But what's interesting is the sunward spike never faltered. It was there the entire time. It's still there now. As I said, that's an indication of the intense electrical discharge going through this particular comet. And there's no question that about the 28th, between the 24th and the 28th, Earth will hook up electrically with this comet, and we could see some interesting phenomena with the comet, with Earth weather, with the new moon passing, and then Venus coming around, all of these conditions, electrical conditions in the solar system.
Okay, well, you're hearing it from James McKenney. And James, before we take calls in just a moment or so, let's talk a little bit about the sun. We're getting close to 2012. What do you think? Anything going to happen?
Well, I think that the solar maximum is going to be late. It looks like it's going to be pushed out into possibly the year 2013. And the solar physicists that I communicate with, I go to meetings with on a regular basis, have talked about the predictions they've made based on past magnetic activity suggest that this will be a little bit less active a solar cycle than maybe the last couple. But I know there's a lot of predictions regarding 2012, but I don't personally see anything myself coming, and of course something can always happen, but I don't personally see anything right now that would indicate 2012 is a unusual year more than any. I know there's talk about galactic alignment.
Yes.
We go through that galactic alignment every year. We have been. You have to understand that the Earth and Sun system, the solar system, moves extremely slowly relative to the galactic structure. And so we've been spinning around in this region of the galaxy for decades, and nothing has happened. So there's nothing magical about 2012 more than any other year, 2013 or 2011 or this year, 2009. So at any rate, there again, I don't see anything there that there's nothing like all of a sudden there's a magical plane that we would go through that would cause, you know, damage or inevitable disasters, those type of things.
Jim, scientists are warning that the right kind of coronal mass ejection that hits us, and if it's an X flare type size, could shut down this country, for example, for months. That's pretty dangerous. Why aren't we doing anything about it?
Well, that's a good question. It's an extremely serious situation, and it's a situation that you have to be prepared for, because if electricity goes out, all of our manufacturing, our ability to pump gas into trucks that would bring potential replacement parts, but the issue is that it would do so much damage to the power grid that it would take years, if not decades, to recover.
What about the satellites that are up there?
And the same with the satellites. We're so dependent on communications and the military, of course. It's really an Achilles heel in the American military because those satellites are extremely vulnerable. We've always assumed that they're up there and nothing can happen to them because they're far out in outer space, but that's simply not the case. They're very vulnerable.
Gee, Jim, we won't be able to text people anymore. What are we going to do?
I don't, don't know what. Most kids would have a tough time. I know that.
Stay with us, Jim. We're going to take phone calls with you next. Here's your opportunity to talk with physicist James McKenney. This is last work, by the way, Atlantis to Tesla, Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, Principia Meteorologica. He's got CDs out. He's one of a kind. And he's next with you. Well, here's your chance now to talk with world-renowned physicist James McKenney. So we're going to take your calls, and next hour we're going to talk about synchronicities and those numbers we see all the time, 11-11. Jim, doesn't Venus rotate counterclockwise as well itself?
It hardly rotates on its axis at all, unlike Earth, Mars, Jupiter. It has a very odd characteristic that it always shows the same side to Earth, much like our moon.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we always see the same side of the moon. Venus has that strange characteristics, which tells me that sometime recently it was locked in a gravitational lock with Earth, and that's one of the anomalies that astronomers don't like to talk about because there's no physical reason for it if these two planets were separated for billions of years, as they claim. But yeah, but Venus hardly rotates at all. So it, in a sense, relative to the Sun, it doesn't have a day or night. It has a one side that's at in nighttime, and the other side is in almost constant daytime.
A NASA astronomer says once Lulin makes its trek around the sun, it'll gain enough speed to escape the solar system. It's gone. It's history. Never come back, right?
Right. That's probably what's going to happen unless something dramatic happens here, but there's nothing in its way. It's not targeted to hit or come close to any of the planets, which could alter its course. So that appears to be what's going to happen.
If a planet like, if a comet like this hit our planet, what would happen?
Oh, this would be bad. I'm not sure how big the nucleus of Lulin is, but let's say it's Halley's size, 7 miles across. It would, coming at 60,000 miles an hour, it would pretty much total out this planet.
Hey, we're toast.
Yeah, it would, yeah. Which just gives you an idea of how tenuous the life in the solar system
burnt toast.
Is. Yeah, I picked out some dates here. Let me see if I can grab my sheet. These are kind of interesting dates. It crossed the orbit of Neptune in 1995 on its way in, December 4th. It crossed the orbit of Uranus, get this, on September 11th, 2001. It crossed the orbit of Jupiter in November of 2007, the orbit of Mars in November of 2008, and it will not go out of the solar system. It'll pass the orbit of Uranus on the way out of the solar system in the year 2016. So this comet will be around for a long time, although probably not very visible since it's small.
Okay, let's go to the phones. You ready, Jim?
Yes.
We'll go to Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hello, Kevin, west of the Rockies.
Good evening.
Hi.
I have a relatively simple question. As far as you talked about if you were facing north in the universe, how do you know what is north in the universe?
So north, if you were at the north pole of the sun or up above the north pole of the Earth from your vantage point,
right,
looking at the solar system, all of the planets would move in a counterclockwise direction. All of the major moons move around their respective planets in that same direction. So it's relative not to the universe, but to just our solar system.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
You are very welcome. Scott in Chico, California, welcome to the show. You are on the air with us. Hey, Scott.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I wanted to ask you something along the lines of George is asking. One night I saw a huge boulder in the sky, and it kind of trekked across. It never, you know, deviated. It just went right across our atmosphere. I say that because I saw like an ash-type tail, almost like you flick a cigarette butt. And it was huge. I could see the scorch marks all over the boulder or asteroid or whatever it was. And I wonder how many of those have gotten so close, but yet we've never known anything because maybe somebody's not telling us because they're worried we're going to get scared.
Well, there are search programs out there. The NEAR program is one of NASA's search programs, and they're trying to discover these, but they can come by. I mean, they already know there are many out there they haven't discovered yet. So there are many that have come into the atmosphere. In fact, recently I've heard about probably five in the last month of objects that have come in. There was one in Canada. There was one in Kentucky. I can't even remember all the locations, but where these have come in recently and just made a fireball at night where people have seen them. But they're all over out there. It's quite a tenuous life in this universe we live in. And, of course, there are some relatively few big ones, but they're out there. And those are the ones, well, of course, any of these hitting Earth could do damage of, you know, a small amount, medium-sized amount, or very serious amount of damage. And I always make the point that there are big objects out there, and they don't have to directly hit Earth. Just coming by in the gravitational and electrical effects can be major, could do major damage to Earth. And historically, we know those things have happened.
Jim, to date, anything getting closer than Apophis, which will be here around 2036, right around there?
Nothing that is known that would be serious. And, of course, 2036 is a very long ways away, so it's very hard to predict those kind of time frames. It's hard to predict 2 months away, let alone time frames like that.
Off to Phoenix, Arizona we go with Todd, the first-time caller. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Dr. Jim. I'd like to know if President Hussein Obama is utilizing global warming as a scam in order to put a lot of money into his stimulus package.
Well, the global warming issue is a pretty controversial issue. It was highly accepted at one time, and now there's a wave of scientists that are saying that there's nothing to global warming. That's what I had said all along. But relative to Obama or what his motivations or what he's doing, I cannot speak for that. I'm sorry.
Okay, let's go to David San Diego. Welcome to the show. Hey, David.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. McKinney, I believe that electronics is still called a theory, and I was wondering why it's still a theory and not a law, and I was wondering if you had a suggestion, since you know so much about electronics, about a book that explains why it's a theory rather than the law. Why it's still called electronic theory rather than electronic law.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, the laws are fairly few and far between. Let's put it like the laws of thermodynamics, let's say, for example. Electronics, I can't really say why they're classified. Sometimes those terms are used rather loosely also. Like the theory of relativity, clearly there's a lot of evidence for special relativity and the way it works, but it's still called a theory. So the terminology, I guess, or force of habit, possibly.
Let's go to Houston, Texas, east of the Rockies. Hey, Joey, go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to find out, is it possible for the comet to veer off course if it were to break up around the sun?
Well, the momentum, for it to break up, and I guess you're implying could it come near Earth, it would have to explode some mass out in the other direction so that part of the mass could come in our direction. And the way it's going right now, something would have to hit it pretty hard and pretty directly for that type of thing to happen. Comets have been known to break apart, but in that case, all the pieces tend to keep going in pretty much the same direction. So in terms of this comet, I don't see an issue with it physically breaking apart and sending debris towards Earth along with its meteor stream or anything else. It's quite far away. 38 million miles is about almost half the way to the sun, for example, which is 93 million miles away. So it's not, you know, it's maybe 40% the distance.
Right, right.
A long ways away.
Jim, what got you interested in comets and the study of?
Well, it was strange. I was doing celestial mechanics, dealing with what's known as the N-body problem. And this is what I was working on before I ever got to Cornell in the 70s, and I had been working on this since I was in college. And I included electromagnetic fields in the calculations just to see what kind of shapes and what kind of equations would come out of this. And I started noticing that all of the different effects that occur in comets could be explained by electromagnetic analysis around rocky objects. And so that's where the comet theory came from. And then by the time I got to Cornell, I started seeing real data. And many of the very subtle effects, like the charging of bodies in a non-uniform plasma, many of these phenomena, I had already worked out all the theoretical work, and then I started seeing the data. And, of course, at that time, the scientists had no clue what they were looking at. And so here I'm looking at data, which is corroborating my theoretical work. So it's just something I was working on in my own little world, I guess, and all of a sudden, there it was, one of those things, synchronicity, George.
Absolutely. Let's go to Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Rod, go ahead.
Mr. McCanny, I've got a quick question for you. Are you familiar with Thomas Bearden's MEG device?
I know about Bearden's work, yes.
Yeah, a buddy of mine and I have tried for the better part of 2 years to promote this thing to get somebody to build the model. We've actually talked with Mr. Bearden, and he said that would be the first step. We've gone through colleges, we've gone through levels of government, and just been thwarted every step of the way. Do you have any advice for us as to where we could go to find somebody with the, you know, the knowledge like yourself in physics to be able to build the model?
The issue with zero point is you have to understand some of the issues with quaternions, that they're not valid at zero points. So one thing, you have to understand some of the theoretical work. But the other issue is funding is the inventor's dilemma, of course, and making small tabletop models or something like that. You have to have a design and a theoretical model before you're going to get serious funding. So it's a long road, certainly difficult one, and many people have found many different routes to get to where they want to go, but there's no magical formula.
You know, they're going to look for some new alternative energy systems under these stimulus packages. It's too bad they can't let a little money loose in these kinds of areas, Jim.
Right, right. But there again, unfortunately, standard science has its agenda, so to speak, and I often wonder when the government starts throwing money into things, the politics of science, of course, that's why I fund my own work. That's why I don't deal with government science at all. I go to the scientific meetings where the government scientists come to, but I personally don't look for government grants or venture capital, anything like that. I do what I can do on my own, and quite frankly, most of the government money ends up in overhead.
Sure.
So you can do an awful lot with not very much when you're innovative. And that's the key, I believe, right there, is you have to find innovation instead of money.
West of the Rockies, Dale in Redding, California. Hi, Dale.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Hello, Dale.
Hello. I was watching television earlier this evening, and there was a public service announcement about something on March 28th where we're all supposed to, like, turn off the light, eliminate our use of energy. I forget what they called it. It was something like Energy Conservation Day or something. And I'm a little concerned that if there's too much of a drop in energy consumption, that it could build up and the grid would be jeopardized. Could you tell me something about that and maybe alleviate my worry?
Well, the planning of electrical power is a very interesting engineering feat, and it's one of the things Obama has talked about, a smart grid where they would remotely control certain devices in your house during peak energy times.
And shut things off, too.
Shut things off, exactly, and turn them back on.
I don't want Big Brother to do that.
Yeah, there's some troubling issues with that entire thing. I think we can save energy in many other ways, and the overall investment of installing that in all the houses in the country.
Jim, next step will be, we don't like what you're listening to on your radio. We're shutting off your power.
Yeah, there's all kinds of implications there. So
that's where we get the batteries out.
Or you're building a energy device in your house, and we're not going to allow you to use energy to do that. But yeah, so there's a lot of concerns about invasion of privacy there, and we can save energy in many other ways. But as far as damaging the grid, that's something that continually goes on, whether it's during peak times or low times. Anyway, I hope that answers the question.
Let's take some final calls here. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, caller east of the Rockies. Harry, go ahead.
Yes.
Sure.
It seems to me that in terms of geological time, intelligent life is very fragile and fleeting. Do you think that we would ever contact or let alone visit intelligent life on another planet?
In another star system, possibly?
Or within our own solar system?
Well,
not in our own solar system, because quite obviously there is no intelligent life in our solar system, unless you're considering the moons of Jupiter,
sure,
or Saturn.
Right. Well, I would think, in terms of there's a higher probability that aliens would come here than we're going to get to them first, given our technology level here. There's, of course, a lot of evidence that we already have been visited, and I just had an interesting thing happen tonight. I was looking at your next guest, George, Marie Jones, on synchronicity, and I said, that's interesting. So I called a friend of mine who's been a long-term member of L.A. MUFON,
mm-hmm.
and as I was making the call, I looked at the clock, and it was 11 after 11.
See, how about that?
And by the way, that has been happening to me for years, and whenever I look at that, it grounds me, I refocus, and it kind of makes me realize in my complex life that I have to focus on the important things. So it's kind of a strange phenomenon when that happens, but the number of times I look at the clock, 11:11 turns up a very high percentage of the time, an inordinate amount of the time.
Jim, what are you working on now?
Right now, I have come out with a new number system. This is a follow-up to the Calculate Primes work, and it's a very interesting number system in that it's based on the prime numbers. In our regular number system, the base 10 system, the prime numbers are all the numbers left out of the number system in the multiplication table. This system is based on the prime numbers, and it's a very interesting concept. So when you look at a number, you know if it's prime or not, plus you know all the factors in it. So that'll be coming out soon.
Very good. Both of Jim's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. I'll be back in a moment as we talk about 11:11, the time prompt phenomenon, next.